Ohio Governor Mike DeWine faces what he's calling one of the biggest decisions he'll make, picking who will replace Vice President-elect J.D. Vance in the U.S. Senate. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we'll talk about the possible contenders for that Senate seat. We'll also discuss President-elect Trump's plans for Greater Cincinnati native Vivek Ramaswamy, hear how former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder is hoping for a pardon, and what Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval had to say in his State of the City address. We've got a lot of ground to cover today. Here to get us started, our Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Haley B. Miller. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here.
And Signal Statewide state politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
No problem. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Haley, former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy has been tapped to help lead this new Department of Government Efficiency. What do we know about this department?
Not a ton yet. Ramaswamy will be leading this effort with Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla and the social media platform X. They are tasked with basically cutting government spending, trying to find excess waste, basically treating it like a business. And President-elect Trump has given them a very specific time frame to do this. They have until July 2026. That's kind of the goal that they've set for themselves. And right now, what we're hearing Ramaswamy and Musk say is that they want other high IQ individuals to join them in this effort and expect not to be compensated, which is the case for Ramaswamy and Musk. They're not being paid to do this. It's still not totally clear if this is a government agency or kind of an outside advisory committee.
Well, and Ramaswamy is from Greater Cincinnati, but kind of exploded onto the political scene last year. Tell us more about him, Haley.
Yeah, so he has been an entrepreneur. He founded a pharmaceutical tech company when he graduated from Harvard and Yale Law School, and then he founded an asset management firm that was previously based in Ohio. It is currently making plans to move to Texas, but Ramaswamy is no longer affiliated with it. And Ramaswamy also is the author of several books, including Woke Inc., which kind of got him on the map, I think. It talked a lot about how, you know, corporate America has become politicized because of various social justice initiatives. So he gained some popularity because of that. He also, I mentioned Yale, he studied at Yale with Vice President-elect J.D. Vance. So they are familiar with each other as well. And, you know, as you noted, he was a presidential candidate. He tried to take on Trump in the primary and failed, but then he became a really vocal surrogate for Trump. And, you know, at 39 years old, I think he's kind of seen as what the future of the GOP could look like.
You mentioned this aggressive timeline for this Department of Government Efficiency. Vivek Ramaswamy has talked about that too.
This Department of Government Efficiency, it is built with an end date. We want to be done by July 4th, 2026. So for the first time in history, creating a department, creating a new government project that is designed to end when its work is complete. That's on the 250th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence, and that's the gift we want to give this country.
Haley, do any of the statements that he made while campaigning for president give any hints about what this Department of Government Efficiency will be looking to do?
I think so. He talked a lot on the campaign trail about what he sees as excess bureaucracy in the federal government. He talked about completely gutting government agencies like the Department of Education, the FBI. You know, there's been discussions out there about whether the Trump administration will, you know, make cuts to things like the National Weather Service even. So what exactly those cuts look like, whether it's infrastructure, personnel, you know, different programs, I think that remains to be seen. You know, I know there have been conversations in the past about just generally speaking about whether, you know, federal offices need to be in D.C. necessarily, whether, you know, something like the Department of Agriculture could be somewhere in the Midwest. So it's still early and still not totally clear what they want to do. But, you know, Musk quipped during the campaign that he thinks they could probably cut $2 trillion and the federal budget. Economists disagree with that, but we'll see what happens.
Well, Andrew, let's talk a little bit more about that. As Haley mentioned, Elon Musk has been tapped to head this department. And he said he wants to reduce the number of federal agencies from 400 down to 99 and cut $2 trillion in federal spending. Any idea how this department could do that?
No, although I think that something that Haley said earlier is that it's not clear that this is actually a government department. I think the name allows it to have the acronym be kind of a meme-worthy reference to cryptocurrency. So it is a big question about whether it's just going to be who follow government call these things blue ribbon commissions, where they make a bunch of recommendations and then shut down. It's a very... The kinds of things they're talking about would be a radical restructuring of the federal government. There's been some talk among Trump supporters in previous years about looking at getting rid of federal bureaucrats that they view as not being sufficiently committed to President Trump during his term, that they think that they were some of the initiatives that he tried to institute then were foiled, and Republicans will call this the deep state. So it is an interesting kind of fusion of a longstanding Republican goal of just cutting federal spending, and then sort of this newer one of, upending kind of civil service protections, kind of out of suspicion about whether the bureaucratic state is, has too much power and is preventing, democratically elected leaders from doing their jobs. So there's just a lot of questions about this. You do have to take seriously the things that Trump and his allies say, especially after they won such a decisive victory in the election, but also it's always hard to separate out, what's rhetoric versus what the actual reality will look like.
And Andrew, you just mentioned cryptocurrency. Are you referring to the fact that this Department of Government Efficiency, the acronym turns out to be DOGE? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I was not going to, elaborate on that unless asked, but there's a thing called Dogecoin. Elon Musk at one point referenced it while he was on Saturday Night Live, which caused its value to skyrocket immediately and then kind of plunge back to earth. I noticed that Dogecoin has become more valuable since this department was announced. So it's sort of silly, but I think it does kind of illustrate how there's an element of the political right now that kind of traffics in memes and kind of online culture. A big part of which is cryptocurrency. But yes, Doge is an internet character. I forget if it's a Pomeranian, but it's a fuzzy little dog that for some reason also is the name of a cryptocurrency.
And is that any kind of conflict of interest that anybody's worried about, that there's this kind of subtle relationship between Doge and this department?
I think that's a fair question. But yeah, I don't know that I've seen anybody discussing that in great detail yet.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's still pretty early in all of this. Haley, we talked about how this government efficiency initiative is supposed to wrap up in July of 2026. Does that leave the possibility open for Vivek Ramaswamy to seek political office in Ohio that year?
Oh, absolutely. He's been floated as a potential candidate for governor in 2026. He was also rumored to be under consideration for the Senate seat to replace Vance. That's obviously not happening, and he acknowledged as much on X after Doge was announced. He said that he was withdrawing his name from consideration for the Senate seat, but said nothing about the governor's race. And our primary that year will be May 2026. And, worth noting that also the deadline for this is July 2026, but who's to say they don't wrap up by the end of 2025 or sometime before that. So he definitely, I would not rule him out for elected office in Ohio.
Andrew, Haley just mentioned that Ramaswamy was talked about as a possible replacement for Senator J.D. Vance, who's now the vice president-elect. How and when will Vance's replacement in the Senate be chosen?
So I'll tackle the when part first. The inauguration is January 20, and the kind of recent comparisons that we have to make include Kamala Harris, who was a senator when she was elected vice president in 2020, and Barack Obama, who also was a senator when he was elected president in 2008. In both instances, they stepped down prior to the inauguration. Obama pretty much resigned immediately. You can imagine that an incoming president would have a lot of really specific work to do. In Harris's case in 2000, maybe a vice president isn't quite as integrally evolved. I mean, it's hard to say whether there's, that one way or the other would be true of Vance. But yeah, so we're just waiting for when that may happen. I don't think he's commented yet on what he's planning on doing. As far as the how, so under state law, Governor Mike DeWine has the authority to fill terms that are vacant in the U.S. Senate for any reason. The law says that he shall forthwith, which is the word that appears, pick an appointment when the vacancy is done. You know, he's indicated that he wants to, in fact, do that quickly. And then that person will serve until through 2026, but there also must be a special election held that year to kind of pick somebody to fill out the term for the remainder of it, which runs through 2028. And so we've heard a lot of names about people who might, fill that role. A lot of people have kind of put themselves in the running, including Ramaswamy, who took himself back out. But it's pretty much up to Mike DeWine and kind of how he sees fit to fill the seat.
And you mentioned that, you know, Kamala Harris was a senator when she was elected vice president, along with President Joe Biden in 2020. How soon did she step down from that role?
It was in mid-January is what I recall, gotcha. Okay. Whereas Obama resigned maybe the week following the election.
Okay. Haley, has Governor DeWine given any hints about who he might appoint or who he definitely won't appoint?
He's keeping his cards pretty close to the vest. I think, a lot of the names out there are people that we know who have expressed interest themselves, who journalists and pundits, think would make sense. We do know that Attorney General Dave Yost has said that he would not accept an appointment if it was presented to him. He is running for governor in 2026 and wants to stay focused on that. It seems Governor DeWine has also gone out of his way multiple times, including during the conversation about the Senate appointment, to say that he believes Lieutenant Governor John Husted would be a good governor. Husted is running for governor in 2026, and with DeWine saying that, even now, that suggests to me that Husted probably is not interested in a Senate appointment. But beyond that, it's a big question mark. But we do know that this is a really important appointment to him as someone who served in the Senate himself. So he's definitely thinking carefully about it.
And Andrew, we had our colleague Howard Wilkinson on the program the day after the election, and he speculated that Ohio Senator Matt Dolan, a state senator who's run in Senate primaries a couple of times now, that he might be a candidate. Is that somebody people are talking about?
Well, so Matt Dolan himself has publicly said that he's interested in the appointment. Dolan previously ran for U.S. Senate earlier this year in the seat that Bernie Moreno ended up winning. And DeWine endorsed him then. And I think if it were really up to DeWine, that somebody like Matt Dolan is somebody that he would like to see in that seat. The two of them share kind of a similar political philosophy, as well as kind of like an approach to how government should work and how politics works. But Dolan finished second in that primary. I believe that Donald Trump, if not in that election previously when he's run for the Senate, has said things like anybody but Matt Dolan. So I think that DeWine would be concerned about somebody like Dolan's ability to win a Republican primary election in 2026. I don't know for sure that means that he won't appoint him, but I think that would be, and I'm not alone in saying this, I think that would be kind of like a big drawback. I don't think DeWine wants to put somebody in this seat who then can actually hold the seat in the future. I think that would be, probably politically embarrassing to him, as well as I think he probably thinks it's important for there to be continuity in this position.
Well, let's move on to some other political news that came up this week. Former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder is hoping President-elect Donald Trump's win could be good news for him. Explain why, Andrew.
So So there's basically his lawyer, Scott Pullins, has said that he's pursuing a renewed effort at getting a clemency for him or a pardon, which there's sort of technical differences between them, but it functionally means they're trying to get him out of prison and have his conviction either overturned or expunged. So I talked with Scott Pullins today, actually, and the way that he views it generally is that, I mean, I think a really simple way to look at it is that it's a Republican president, so maybe a Republican president would be more amenable to, doing something like this for a Republican politician. But Pullins also hopes that Trump might be sympathetic to the idea that a federal criminal investigation may not have been done fairly, or that maybe, that he was had political implica or political motivations or something like that. So I'm not saying that's true about this case, but he hopes that making that argument will resonate with Trump.
Well, and Householder's lawyer, as you mentioned, thinks the case will resonate with the president-elect.
If you really look at the case and you look past the headlines and all the online anger, his case, Speaker Householder's case, is very, very similar to some of the things that President Trump went through.
Haley, are there any indications of whether President-elect Trump will pardon Larry Householder?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, I suspect there's going to be a long list of individuals hoping to seek a pardon or clemency or something from Trump, people who may see him as sympathetic. We know Trump has talked about pardoning defendants from the January 6th insurrection a few years ago. So time will tell. You know, he's issued pardons in the past. So, you know, I think he's generally open to the idea if he feels like, you know, the particular case, you know, resonates with him.
And Haley, remind us what Larry Householder was convicted of.
So he was convicted of racketeering in the House Bill 6 scandal. He was found to have orchestrated the whole thing, you know, a pay-to-play scheme that helped First Energy bail out nuclear plants, and then in return, the Ohio House led by Larry Householder at the time passed legislation, you know, favorable to First Energy, and there's a lot of money and things exchanged for that to happen. So he's serving a 20-year prison sentence for that. Former Ohio Republican Party Chair Matt Borges was also convicted in that case and is serving, I think, 6 years. Andrew can correct me if I'm wrong. So a lot less time than Larry Householder, but, you know, both of them were dinged for that.
Yeah. And Andrew, does Larry Householder have any kind of connection with President-elect Trump other than the fact that they're both Republicans?
So what I remember was back at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in 2016, it seems like, I mean, it was a long time ago, but politically it was a very long time ago. Leading up to that event, then Ohio Governor John Kasich was running for president himself. And the state party at the time, including Borges that Haley just referenced, was very loyal to Kasich. There's a lot of conflicts between the Trump team and the state Republican party and also its members. And so I bring it up because Householder was actually asked to speak during the convention. It was the former longtime state party chair had passed away, and Householder kind of spoke on the screen. So that's just an example. I mean, it was a big honor to be able to do that, and kind of in the pageantry of a Republican event, it kind of rubbed people the wrong way within the party at the time. But that's the big connection. There's been some. The House Bill 6 itself was lobbied for by so many different elements of the state political system, including Bob Poduchik, who has kind of ties to the coal industry. There's Corey Lewandowski also was lobbying on behalf of that, who is Trump's former campaign manager. So there's both kind of that history that we kind of know from the surface. There's also some of that lobbying that takes place. So it's hard to say whether that's going to do anything for him or not, because I guess I want to emphasize that there are a lot of different elements of the state Republican and Democratic parties and unions that were involved with the House Bill 6 process. But those are some of the connections that come to mind, at least. And it's not that hard to make them.
We've been talking a lot about Ohio Republicans. Andrew, which Ohio Democrats are considering political runs in 2026, either for U.S. Senate or for governor?
So, yeah, the big question here, I think, obviously, you know, people who have lived here and followed these things know that the Democrats have had a hard time here for a really long time. They've rarely won state elections for state office. They've had some success in federal presidential elections previously, but in the last decade or so, the state's become more and more reliably Republican, including in the election this month. So at this moment, Democrats are feeling pretty demoralized about the results. But on the other hand, kind of on its face, it'll be an open seat for the governor's office. The Senate seat will be a new appointee. And generally speaking, when a particular party holds the White House, the opposing party benefits from a kind of national backlash against that party. So some of the names that people were talking about going into the election included Alison Russo, who's the she's an Upper Arlington Democrat in the state house. She's the top Democrat there. There's Amy Acton, who previously was the state health department director under Mike DeWine during the pandemic. But since the election itself took place and kind of some of this, you know, it's clear what kind of environment it's going to be. Tim Ryan, who is a former congressman from the Youngstown area who ran and lost for the Senate in 2022, has said he's keeping his options open. I know that he's hearing from people encouraging him to run. People, even though he lost in 2022, he impressed particularly national Democrats with kind of the vigorous campaign that he ran. And then also Sherrod Brown is somebody that you have to think about. He just lost just a couple weeks ago, and kind of like the dust is still settling on that. But he actually gave an interview to Politico in which he said that he's not ruling out running for the Senate in 2026. So those are some of the names that definitely people, you know, should look out for. It's always a problem for Democrats to find candidates to kind of fill out the down ballot races. But so it's an interesting question whether this would be like 2018 when Democrats nationally did see a pretty good political environment. They could have won here in Ohio, but they didn't. So the Democrats then here had a pretty good slate of candidates that year and thought they might win. So, you know, this year, will they think that that's going to be the case again? Or are they going to see more? Are they going to think more like that Republicans just won the state by 12 points? It's kind of, you know, it's really hard. Ohio's a red state. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of candidates they draw out and what kinds of, how Democrats view their chances here as the election gets closer.
Well, and Haley, state lawmakers are back in Columbus to wrap up their 2-year legislative session. Who's in the running to be the next Speaker of the Ohio House?
So the two people that we've heard about consistently this whole time is House Speaker Jason Stevens. He's going to be making another go at it. And then Senate President Matt Huffman, he was term limited in the Senate, so he'll be moving over to the House in January and wants to, you know, take on a leadership role again. We've also heard some murmurs about Representative Ron Ferguson, but I think it's probably going to come down to Huffman and Stevens. And, you know, Stevens had a really divisive tenure as Speaker because he was chosen with the help of House Democrats. And since then, it hasn't been a particularly productive chamber because Republicans have been divided. So given that environment, I think Huffman has a good chance to take over the position and perhaps unite the caucus.
And Andrew, how soon will House Republicans decide who the next Speaker is going to be?
So there is a vote, kind of an informal private vote scheduled next Wednesday among House Republicans in which they'll basically decide this question. Typically, these votes have been in effect the actual caucus vote, and then the person who they choose then subsequently gets picked Speaker. Kind of the question mark, and the reason why I'm even describing all of this is that in 2022, in November 2022, Republicans picked Derek Marin to be their next Speaker. He basically, for all intents and purposes, expected to get the job and was preparing for it when Jason Stevens surprised people by getting the Democratic votes, becoming Speaker himself a few weeks later when the actual official vote was held and the legislature convened. So the vote will be next Wednesday. We should know who the next Speaker will be after that, although I'm going to hedge and say we've thought that before and it turned out not to be the case. So that official vote will take place in January.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer politics reporter Haley B. Miller and Signal Statewide state politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Happy to do it.
Up next, what is Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purifol saying about youth violence in his State of the City address? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purifol delivered his third State of the City address this week, highlighting accomplishments from the past year and challenging residents to keep moving forward. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about what the mayor had to say is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Always great to have you here. As I mentioned, the mayor gave his State of the City address this week. A key issue he talked about was youth violence. It's something that Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thiges talked to us about as well. What do the numbers show in Cincinnati?
So there's one particular statistic that he pointed out, one looking at shootings. So an overall 7.5% decrease in shootings compared to 2023, obviously going in a positive direction. Specific to youth, however, a 35% decrease in youth shootings. Now, folks may remember there has been kind of an increase, a spike in shootings involving teenagers, both as victims and as charged perpetrators in shootings. And so that's a pretty significant piece there. To see that. Now, obviously, there are other issues related to, you know, youth conflict that don't necessarily involve guns. And so that's something that he didn't get into too much detail. But that 35% decrease, certainly a win.
And that was the shootings were elevated last year, right? So that 35% decrease is down from a pretty high number last year.
That's right. Although it is the second year in a row that shootings overall have decreased, which honestly last year made it all the more significant that youth shootings increased while overall shootings decreased. So second year in a row of an overall decrease, but then a 35% decrease, but pretty significant.
Yeah. What were some of the key issues he identified with that, with the problem of youth shooting in particular? Or youth violence, I guess I should say.
Yeah. So something, again, that he didn't go into too much detail on, though, is the issues with CPS and the government square in particular. So obviously it's a pretty complicated issue, but the idea of teens using the metro buses as transportation, which is necessary for CPS, and then just kind of causing lots of teens all together in one area. But really with shootings in particular, he really boils it down to the availability of guns. So with all of the violence that is experienced, what he calls the universal accessibility of guns, he says is unacceptable, and it will remain unacceptable until we put a stop to it. So this message of, you know, progress is a great thing, but it doesn't mean that there isn't more work to do.
What are some of the solutions he said the city's working on?
So there are a sort of task force that has been working on Government Square in particular, but also some other transit centers in the city, not just in Government Square. And those have been volunteers for now, but those will be paid positions sometime in the future. This council has approved some funding for that. Also some partnerships with UC Health to work on some of these issues and really just conflict resolution in general. So this idea, not just of the accessibility of guns, but of solving conflict in ways that don't involve violence of any kind. So certainly a lot of different programs, nothing really new announced in this speech, though, just kind of programs that have been continuing, but just emphasizing that those are continuing.
Mm-hmm. He also talked about medical debt. What has the city been doing to provide medical debt relief, and where does that work stand?
Yeah, so this is a program that was announced quite a while ago, but is just kind of getting off the ground. So it's this idea that the city has plans to forgive $134 million in residents' medical debt. What the mayor announced at his State of the City address is that in just the first 2 months, the city has already abolished $47 million in debt, and that's for more than 52,000 Cincinnati residents. That's since the program launched in September. Now, as a reminder, the way this works is hospital systems, particularly UC Health, is the first in this partnership. When folks don't pay their medical bills, hospital systems have the option to sell that for pennies on the dollar to debt collectors. And then they are trying to get at least some of that recouped. So instead of selling it to a debt collector, the city can step in with those pennies on the dollar and basically purchase and forgive millions of dollars worth of debt with much less money. money available. And so that's what's been done so far. So again, $47 million forgiven so far for more than 52,000 Cincinnatians.
Wow. He also talked about housing insecurity. What's it been doing when it comes to housing insecurity?
Yeah, so a couple of programs that have been in progress for a while now. So for example, legal representation through legal aid. Now this is like, say you get an eviction notice and you are looking for some help on how to respond in court. You can try and get in touch with a legal aid attorney. There are not very many of them. The funding is pretty, you know, low. And so it's difficult to get into that. Something more recently that the city has started doing is same day representation. So that means you've not spoken to an attorney at all. You show up to eviction court that day. There is an attorney that is paid for in part by the city funds that can now say, let's ask for a continuance. Let me look at your case. And it really is a pretty unique situation where you can just show up and say, I didn't know I would have access to legal representation, but that person can say, I'm here. Let's go into that case. That's something that launched more recently as well. In most of those cases, the evictions have been dismissed. And so having that legal representation has been a huge benefit for those tenants.
Yeah. And did he talk about how many people have been able to take advantage of that so far?
Between January and September, now this is for the sort of overall program, the rental assistance and free legal representation has been offered to 542 households. Mm-hmm. And that includes more than 700 children in throughout those households. Wow. Now, that's not just the same day representation I mentioned. That's starting from January to September for all of the legal representation and sort of eviction related programs the city has.
Okay. Briefly, what are some of the big issues the mayor and city council will face in 2025?
The biggest one is budget. That is the number one thing. So, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about federal stimulus. The American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, is the most recent one of that. And that money has filled a deficit in the city budget every year for the last several years. So it is the only reason that there haven't been budget cuts is because of that federal stimulus. So this is the last year that stimulus can be used. So starting July 1st for the next fiscal year, there will be no more stimulus available for that. And there is a projected deficit. So that's going to be the biggest thing. Obviously, the Futures Commission report is kind of a blueprint or a starting point, at least, to try and solve some of those budget issues. But there's a lot in there. And the city is still working through kind of vetting some of those ideas, including the possibility of some earnings tax increases or asking voters for permission to raise the earnings tax. But there's a long way to go on all of those recommendations.
Yeah, you mentioned the earnings tax increase. That was something the Futures Commission recommended, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, and they recommended a new trash collection fee.
That's
also
right.
Both of those things are pretty controversial. Mm-hmm. Did the mayor indicate whether those are things that the city council will be willing to tackle in 2025?
Not in this address, no. Now, when the mayor formed the Futures Commission, it was about 2 years ago in his first State of the City address when he announced the formation of the Futures Commission. And he said then and has said consistently since then that all options should be on the table, that there should be, you know, everything should be considered in terms of what we need to do to fix the budget. That said, you know, there's kind of no word yet on what happens next. Like I said, there's a lot of vetting going on. But in the speech, there was no indication about whether or not the mayor personally is in favor of that.
Okay. And the mayor has, this is the last, coming up is the last year of his first term in office.
That's right. 2025.
Said he plans to run again, and all of city council will be on the ballot.
That's
too, right.
All 9 seats.
Yeah, so that could be an interesting year to take up controversial stuff.
It will. And this was, you know, council could have put the earnings tax increase on the ballot this year. But obviously, with a presidential election, that introduces a lot of unknown elements into, you know, who will be voting, how many people will be voting, and the success of that. So it's kind of 2 years in a row of a lot of potential uncertainty there. So it'll be interesting to see how they decide to move forward.
Okay. Well, and for people who want to get into more detail, you have a copy of the mayor's full State of the City address on our website, WVXU.org. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, we explore the question, can a factory town survive without the factory? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. My next guest recently posed this question: can a factory town survive without the factory? The Hamilton County Village of Addiston is about to find out. WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk joins me now to talk about why. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. The INEOS ABS plant has announced its closure. Now, this was the plant that was in the news because of the recent styrene leak. Explain that connection.
I don't think there is a connection between that and the closure, but it is an incident that happened just a few weeks before they announced the closure, which they blamed on global competition. They say they need investments in order to make the plant run profitably and sustainably, and they can't afford those given the state of the market today. This plant has had pollution problems, though, over many years, and probably the biggest and most memorable one was a 2005 incident where a series of accidental emissions of harmful chemicals led to the closure of a school in Addiston. And really, in many ways, that town has not recovered from that 2005 mishap. Mm.
And more recently, the styrene leak, that the train car filled with styrene was on its way to this plant, right?
Yeah, they were. It came from one INEOS plant to another one. The first one was in Texas, where the material was made. And styrene is used to make plastic pellets that are used in car parts and toys and all kinds of other plastic products. And so they were shipping the styrene to the Cincinnati plant or the Addiston plant. And they haven't fully explained why, but when it arrived, they said they didn't have the capacity to accept it. And so the railroad allowed it to sit on their tracks about 4 miles to the west of the Addiston plant. And while it was sitting there for a period of about 7 to 8 days, one of the cars, the material started to polymerize and heat up, and that led to the release of the styrene. It's actually a liquid, but it comes out looking like a gas. And so that led to evacuations in Cleves and Whitewater Township. And, it was a big industrial incident, basically, that is still being investigated by the Federal Railroad Administration and others.
And you mentioned that this styrene gets converted into these plastic pellets. Is that what the plant in Addiston does, turns the styrene and other chemicals into these plastic products?
They produce the raw materials for plastic, and styrene is one ingredient in those raw materials. Yeah, so they ship either styrene in a liquid form to other manufacturers, or they ship these pellets that are then used to make the finished product that you see in cars and other kinds of, like, cell phones, for example.
Okay. This factory, though, has been around a lot longer than INEOS has. Walk us through the history.
Yeah, it was founded in 1889 as a pipe foundry by a man by the name of Matthew Addy, and that's where the name Addiston comes from. He platted streets across from the factory to house workers, and 2 years after the founding of the plant, the town of Addiston was incorporated. And so that was a pipe foundry up until about 1951, when Monsanto bought the company and converted it to a plastics plant. And then since then, it's been operated by four owners: Monsanto, Bayer, Lanxess, and INEOS, which is the owner today.
How important has this business been to the village of Addiston over all these years?
Well, they said that their 180 employees now represent about $300,000 in annual income tax for the village, which is more than a third of its total budget. And we saw how important that amount was a couple of days after our story ran. Addiston Council voted to disband the police department, which happens to cost about $300,000 a year. And instead, they're going to contract with Hamilton County to patrol Addiston's streets. So I think this is not going to be the last cut that Addiston is forced to make. When they announced the disbanding, they said it was in part because of the expected budget cuts from the INEOS plant closure. And they also also said that you know, they've been having staffing issues, you know, for years in that department, and they've had other problems as well. So it wasn't entirely due to the INEOS closure, but it is one representation of how the town is going to be impacted in the years ahead.
Well, and this plant covers a lot of property too, right? Any idea what will happen to all that acreage and the buildings on it?
So far, all INEOS has said publicly is that they'll do a safe and responsible decommissioning process, which means they could do some environmental remediation. They could do demolition of the or dismantling of the factory. It's really not clear what they're planning exactly. The mayor told me that she met with INEOS leaders a few days before our story ran, and they assured her that the that they are going to decontaminate the plant. That's the word she used. So, it looks like the EPA will likely get involved and oversee the decommissioning of this plant. And with any luck, that will mean that any contaminants that are now on the site won't be there after the plant is fully closed.
Have representatives of the company sat down and talked with you or answered specific questions that you've sent their way?
No. They put out a press release on the 30th, I believe, of last month. And I sent them a list of 18 questions, and their only response was essentially what was in the press release.
You mentioned this 2005 incident that folks around there will remember. What kind of environmental track record does this company have otherwise?
Well, that 2005 incident came in the year that this plant had its most ever emissions of toxic chemicals. So that was the recent peak. That was the highest level since 2000. And after that, there was a steady decline in total emissions, and that continued until about 2014. Now, INEOS took over the plant in 2007, and so they were part of those improvements. But then starting in 2015, you saw a gradual uptick in emissions through about 2018, and that is happens to be a period during which the EPA alleged they were not properly monitoring valves and connectors, you know, between the pipes, and those are pollution control systems. Basically, you have to monitor any valves for leakage, and so in September of this year, INEOS agreed to pay a $181,000 penalty for this, for these, you know, for failing to monitor their pollution control systems. Since 2018, again, there's been a gradual decline and a bit of a spike in 2022, and then it came back down in 2023. So overall, I would say their track record is better than it was in the 90s and you know, since 2005. But they still have some meaningful emissions and some pretty harmful chemicals, including styrene and acrylonitrile and butadiene. Two of the three of those are suspected cancer causers.
Well, and you talked to a resident who's, I believe, also a village council member now, who said you can kind of, he's been able to kind of smell the work from the plant over the years, hasn't he?
Yeah, he was talking about when he was a kid. This guy Dan Pillow has been a mayor or council member for about 20 of his 70 plus years. He lives in a house just a few doors down from where he grew up, and he said they would, you know, play ball all day long in that village, and they never thought much of the pollution or the damage from it, but they said the smell was everywhere, and he referred to it as the smell of money.
Because that's where so many people worked, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think at one point that plant had close to 1,000 employees. Now it's down to about 180.
Wow. Now, you mentioned that it's looking like there will be some kind of EPA oversight of the decommissioning of this plant, but is that a sure thing? I thought your story had some information about sort of a complicated corporate structure involved that could throw some of that oversight into question?
Yeah, I talked to an attorney from Earth Justice, which is an environmental sort of nonprofit law firm, kind of a watchdog agency, and they said that the way the ownership of that plant is structured, it if you go on into the annual reports of the INEOS Group, which is the global petrochemical company, I think they're like the sixth largest chemical company on the planet, huge company, but they don't list the Addison plant as one of their 45 facilities that they own and operate. Instead, this is they consider it a contract manufacturer, and it is its orders come from a subsidiary of INEOS Group called Styrolutions or Styrolutions. And so they are the exclusive representative of INEOS ABS products. And the products made here are sold by this INEOS entity, but it's really not clear who owns that plant. And what the attorney told me was that's a potential problem because, you know, if this is an independent company that has limited assets, it will be hard for the EPA or anybody to attach, you know, liability to this LLC, this limited liability company. And so he said that's a risk that that will have to be addressed if and when the EPA oversees its cleanup.
And then we just have a minute or so left. Do you have any sense for what the future looks like for Addison without this plant?
You know, they've had problems with population declines, partly because of the pollution issues, but partly just because it's a small town. The housing stock is old. And so, you know, without some kind of capital infusion or some kind of real development effort, an intensive investment on this area, it doesn't really look good. It's only a town of 1,400 people down from about, it's 900 people down from about 1,400 in the 1960s. So, you know, they're going to have to look for ways to invest and reinvent themselves and do it without the capital that they got from this plant.
Well, I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan, and for this reporting.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts, and you won't want to miss our Thanksgiving coverage. On Monday, November 25th, we'll have our annual Thanksgiving cooking show, followed by the pet show the next day. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.